We all love mob movies. Scarface, The Godfather, the list goes on and on. But there's one movie that speaks to me above all others. Donnie Brasco starring Johnny Depp. In season one of Deep Cover, we discovered the real story behind Donnie's time undercover with the New York Mafia and what it was like spending 6 years with some of the wildest wise guys you'll ever come across. I'm your host, Leo Rossi, and I've spent my life behind and in front of the cameras creating stories about the mob. This season, we're going even deeper into the Donnie Brasco story. We'll learn more about the man behind the persona, Joe Pistone, and his time as the most decorated undercover agent in FBI history.
This week on Deep Cover, the real Donnie Brasco. Leo and Joe are joined by Dr. Frank, a criminal psychiatrist and old colleague of Joe's. Together, they go deep inside the minds of some of the coldest and meanest gangsters around, while Dr. Frank explains what exactly the difference is between the mentality of a murdering mafioso and a cold-blooded serial killer.
To all our listeners out there, this show, we have a special guest. I want to say that the guests that we have on this show, they are friends of Joe Pistone. And we look forward to them coming over. I mean, that's the way it feels, because the ice is broken, because they know Joe and they know all his peccadillos. But for now, Joe, introduce our special guest.
Leo, I'd like you to meet a good friend of mine, Dr. Frank. Frank and I go back to probably 1973, 1974 in the New York office of the FBI. I stayed on to be, you know, finish my career. But Frank went into the medical field. His medical training, he hit all bases. Georgetown University Hospital, New York Presbyterian, Massachusetts General, Harvard Medical School.
Harvard.
And professorships at Rutgers University and Seton Hall University. Now, Frank started out to be a surgeon, Leo.
Okay.
Got his degree in surgery, did surgery for a few years, and then he decided, you know, let me try something else. And he became a psychiatrist. And now Dr. Frank is the head of psychiatry at a couple major hospitals. Frank, we've been friends for a long time, and I love you like a brother. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Leo. It's a real, real pleasure to be here and an honor.
Well, it's Joe has been looking forward to this also. Now, I was born in Trenton, New Jersey. Joe was born in Paterson. Where were you born?
In Astoria, Queens, New York.
Oh. I won't say all the cops, but a great many cops that work in New York City, they live in Queens.
I was told that in Flushing, Queens, they have the most Medal of Honor winners in general come from Queens.
You know, I heard that too, Frank.
It's a real honor to be from that borough where, if this indeed is true.
When you see the five boroughs, people don't understand it. There was a show, Welcome Back, Cotter. Do you remember that, Frank?
Oh, sure.
The comedy.
Gabe Kaplan.
Gabe Kaplan. And the first thing that came up on the screen was Brooklyn, the fourth largest city in America at that time. I mean, that's just one of the boroughs, and it was the fourth largest city population-wise. The five boroughs, they defy gravity. But you went to school for surgery. I guess you had a chance to look into the minds.
I did. I thought when I graduated med school, for a few years I wrote, I thought I wanted to be a Michael Crichton, who actually graduated from med school and never did a day of residency or training and just wrote novels. And I wrote for a couple of newspapers. I wrote health columns, but I mean, I was obviously no Michael Crichton. So I said, I better go back and do my postgraduate training. So initially, I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and I applied to different programs, and I was very lucky and blessed to get into the Georgetown program for general surgery, where I started out. And in your first year, you kind of touch on every aspect of surgery, all the different specialties, general surgery, ENT, urology, neurosurgery, what have you. And then I did my time in neurosurgery and I thought, this is not for me. And I was a bit lost. And I had the pleasure of coming in contact with one of the deans there who was a Jesuit priest. He passed away, a lovely, lovely man, Father John O'Brien, and a brilliant man. He was a dean at the medical school. He had gone to Yale Law School and was a Jesuit priest, a Yale-trained lawyer, a physician, and a psychiatrist.
Wow.
And Father O'Brien used to meet with me on weekends at the Jesuit residence at Georgetown, and I was always exhausted. And I'd go there on a Sunday morning, and I would go to Mass, and I'd go to the Jesuit residence, and I'd ring the bell. They'd let me in. I said, I'm here to see Father O'Brien. And by the time he came down, I was asleep in the chair because I was on call every other night. And he used to say, Frank, you got to get some sleep. I says, well, Father, you know, I'm a surgical resident. I'm on call every other night. So he would talk to me and he listened to me. And when I said to myself, I don't want to do neurosurgery, I think I want to be a neurologist because I was interested in the brain and that kind of stuff. And he listened and he listened. He asked me about what I did in the past. He says, you know what, Frank? I think you'd be a better psychiatrist. I said, what? I said, I don't want to be a psychiatrist. And he introduced me, I got to tell you, to some of the coolest guys who were psychiatrists and neuropsychiatrists at Georgetown. And these guys were unbelievable. They so inspired me. And I said, no, that's what I want to do. So I finished my first year in general surgery. And then I applied to psychiatry residencies. And I was lucky enough to get into New York Presbyterian, where I did my residency. And then I wanted to really focus on neuropsychiatry, which is the combination of neurology and psychiatry. And I applied to different programs, and I had an interview at Johns Hopkins, but I also had an interview at Mass General. And interestingly enough, the program director of Mass General, another brilliant guy, was also a Jesuit priest and a psychiatrist. And that's where I wanted to go because of the Jesuit influence. And I was lucky enough to get accepted to the Mass General program, which is part of the Harvard system. And I went there and I did my fellowship in what we call psychosomatic consultation psychiatry, which was their form of neuropsychiatry. And that's what I did in my training. And then I got out and now I'm doing what I do now.
I got to say, Frank, you, with the medical school, just to even get accepted, and then neurosurgery and everything, you must have been a hell of a student.
Well, I did okay, and I think I was very lucky, and I think I was very blessed. And I think I was lucky enough to come across wonderful people who took an interest in me, guided me, and went to bat for me. And that's why I'm here today, and I'm very happy with what I do.
Leo, Frank is being very modest. Like I said, I've known him for a long time. He's highly intelligent and very smart. So I think that had more to do than his saying, you know, he got lucky.
Yeah, I will say this. I am a product of Catholic grammar school, high school, and university. Okay? And I had a set of Franciscans, Augustinians, but everybody knows when it comes to education, it's the Jesuits. They focus on education. They hit first and ask questions later, at least in my era, they did, you know. But they really care about the student and the education. I have friends that have gone on to become doctors, and you verify that by your relations with them, you know. You do kill me a little bit every time, and it's been said five times. Four times by you and once by Joe, I went to Villanova, Georgetown.
But Villanova is a great school.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, it is, but we hated Georgetown. Oh, boy, did we hate Georgetown. But it was a great rivalry.
It was. And Villanova is a great university. I mean, there's not, and the Augustinians there, St. Augustine. I mean, what a great education, and it's a very, very, very special place and a very difficult place to get into. So, Leo, you must have been a very bright fellow too.
Well, I'm
sure you are.
You know, and I I have the gift of the gab, but thank you. And the one thing, you know how they have in Catholic school, you're the class this when you're a freshman in class. And I thought that I had dibs on being class president. I mean, I thought that was a no-brainer, right? But I was late 61 times my junior year because I picked up six guys in my car, which they affectionately called the Guinea Mobile, right? And then I have to drop them off at school and go six blocks to park, and I was always late.
But you see, Leo, as the Jesuits would say, you were a man for others. So you put all those other people ahead of you and got them to school on time. And as the sisters, the nuns used to tell me in grammar school, your reward is in heaven.
For our listeners wondering why the hell we got Dr. Frank on here, Leo, I don't know if I told you, but I recruited Dr. Frank to be an instructor at a couple of my undercover schools to basically talk to the students about how the mind works, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Frank, I'd like you to give a little insight into, you know, some of the words of wisdom that you imparted to some of my students.
Well, I think when Joe and I came together for the schools, Joe asked me to take essentially a twofold approach to speaking to the undercovers who were there. One is the first approach was to deal with the individuals that they will come up against, the people who they need to deal with. And of course, Joe was a perfect example of somebody who not only had to deal with them, but he lived with them. You know, he was embedded with them. As we say, he was a long-term undercover. He was, at that time, the only person. I mean, I don't know if anybody has ever done anything like Joe since that. So I was there to tell him about the different types of people that they might encounter, and where they're coming from, how they think, why they do the things they do. And the second tier of what I did, Joe asked me to do, was speak to them about how to be a good undercover, to the best of my knowledge. Now, of course, I never did anything like Joe did. But what I did is I tried to, having been trained as a psychiatrist, having spent time in the Bureau, I got to understand both, we can use the term the criminal mind, and then what really is needed to be a good undercover. And of course, my go-to person was Joe. Having known Joe for years and having tried to understand Joe and where he was coming from. So that's really what I did. And I would speak to them about the individuals that they would encounter. And then I would speak to them about what would be needed to be a good undercover. And then I would break off and meet with them, let's say, later in the day, personally, to see how, you know, to more or less interview them and see where they were coming from, available to answer questions and help where I could. And that was really my approach to the schools that Joe ran and he involved me in.
This is fascinating to me. With you talking to them, let's just reverse it a little bit. The ones that are going to be undercover agents, and you talking to them, what were three or four or however many signs that they should look for, ask themselves about if they want to go with undercover?
Well, I think the number one thing, and I think Joe really epitomizes this, and he's said this, is, and it goes along with a good state of mental health, and that is to have a good sense of yourself. That's the most important thing. So if you're Joe and I would talk, and I would ask Joe, and for instance, Joe is not a big drinker. He never was a big drinker. Till this day, if we go out, I don't even think he gets a glass of wine with dinner. He has an iced tea. And this is Joe. He just doesn't drink. And of course, if you do drink, if you're a big drinker, that's a slippery slope. You don't want to go down that path. But you, one goes undercover, and a lot of these people would the people you deal with, the drinkers, they do drugs, they snort coke, they whatever. You can't succumb to that. You can't become one of them in that sense. You have to remain separate from that. You have to have that good sense of self, and not engage in that. So you have to be able to let them know that this is not you. You don't do it. And you have to have a legend, so to speak, why you don't do it. It's just not you, what have you. Joe has a friend who is an MI5 fellow. And I remember meeting him in Kensington in England. We went to lunch, and I asked him about the IRA. He went undercover with the IRA years ago. And I asked him, I said, what were these guys like? Well, I mean, he said, we would go out and they would start to drink, and they would drink 13, 14, 15 pints of Guinness, and they'd get all fired up. But of course he didn't, because that's not him. So he had to somehow be himself, because he had a good sense of self, yet be ingratiated by them. And then he could do his job. But if he said, oh, I better start drinking because they drink, forget it. It's a disaster. So to answer your question, you have to have a real good sense of yourself, be comfortable with yourself, and remain yourself when you're undercover.
Well, everybody thinks it's an acting job, and to a degree, it is.
Yes.
That's what I've done for a lot of years. But the closer that you can make that character that you're portraying, Donnie Brasco, to yourself, you're saying that that's enhances your potential for success.
Correct. And what people don't realize, too, is that you take the intelligence community versus the law enforcement community. So you take organizations like the CIA versus the FBI. CIA are always undercover. They go into the case officers. They go into a country. They have a false name. They have a false position at the embassy. Or if they're a knock, they're not even involved with the embassy. They're out there. But they can break the law. What they do overseas is illegal, technically. So they can do anything and get away with it. And they don't have to testify in court. But guys like Joe Pistone can do all this stuff. And not only do they have to get information and collect data on the wise guys, but they have to do it legally, and they have to gather information that's going to stick in court to get these people prosecuted. So Joe is in constant contact with the United States attorneys, the assistant United States attorneys, and he had to gather this data. So it's a much more involved type of undercover, I think, than the other types of undercover. And it really, there's a, believe it or not, besides the obvious stuff, the bravery, the staying power, you know, the acting, the being yourself, There's a very big intellectual component to what the law enforcement undercovers do, in particular what Joe did.
You know, he's my hero. He has said on the show many times, he was, when he was dealing with those people, he never forgot who he was and who they are. And he did it for 6 years. I don't know how the hell he did it. Maggie, she used to probably keep a baseball bat. That's Joe's wife, Maggie. Every time he came home, you hit him in the head. You know, it's like when you are with the people and then you go, I remember playing ball, playing sports, and you go home and you say, pass the fucking peas. What? Where did that come from? My father would want to give me a whack. It's, you know, you get into show me your friends, I'll show you who you are. But Joe really never fell prey to that.
No. And to a certain degree, you have to compartmentalize what you do. It's almost like Leo, you said, to a degree, you have to be an actor. And it's like when you're on Broadway and the curtain opens, you're on. And then once the curtain closes, you can go back to being yourself. But to a certain degree, even when you're on in Joe's business, it's somewhat different than acting in that Joe's is a matter of life and death.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the acting aspect, you may get a bad review by the critics or what have you. But with Joe, if he screws up, it can be a little more serious.
What would you say to an undercover suggestions or whatever to keep your stress level down?
The most obvious thing is to go home and have a drink or two. But that's a very slippery slope. I think what's important is to, you know, exercise is excellent. Meditation. I mean, I think for us three guys, growing up Catholic, being, you know, Leo and I went to Catholic schools, the prayer, I think a good prayer life, a good relationship with your God is important, and a good support from your family. And Joe, you were in a very unique situation because you really didn't get the opportunity to be with your family or very often. A lot of these undercovers who do a job for 2-3 days and then they go home and what have you, and so they can unwind. But for somebody like you, it's a very different story, and that's why it's even more important to have a very good sense of yourself, a very good sense of what you're doing, and it becomes all about the mission and not you. And that's really what's important, I think. I think to realize that you're doing it for a greater good. It's all about the mission, and you have to kind of put yourself second. You know, the other thing is, you can't be narcissistic and be a good undercover, because you can't go around telling people, "Look what I did! Isn't this great? Give me a medal, whatever." This is not that kind of stuff. That sense of what you're doing. And the sense of a feeling of accomplishment has to come from within. And those are the important things, I think, some of the important things at least, that are needed for a good undercover.
Doc, let me ask you another question. A serial killer, I think the FBI, they classify if you've killed 3 people, they put a label on you, serial killer. I mean, that's the number that I used to know. These wise guys, they're given contracts, kill somebody by the family. It doesn't have to be the mafia. These other gangs, for no other reason that, you know, they stole money from the family, they broke some of the rules. So they may have 5, 6, 7, 8 hits under their belts. Are they serial killers, or are they just hitmen for whoever organization they're with? I mean, as far as the mind goes.
Well, what the FBI says, you know, is one thing. That's a formal definition, how they want to define someone who's a serial killer. To the best of my knowledge, Joe, I think people who do it as a job, whether they are hitmen, whether they are special operators within the government, Delta Force people, Navy SEALs, or whatever, it's a little different because it's a profession. And true, I mean, it's somewhat a lot of people are not able to do those kinds of things, but it's still, I mean, they're getting paid for it, whether you're in the government or whether some captain in the mob is paying you to do a hit. My opinion is, that's very different than a Jeffrey Dahmer or
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy
was, yeah.
I mean, I mean, I'm sure some of the guy, Joe, you know, had the place in Brooklyn and used to cut up the bodies. I'm sure he enjoyed that kind of stuff. It sounds that way. So maybe he was on the edge where he did it professionally, but enjoyed it too. But I would assume that I don't know for sure, but some of these wise guys who are hitmen, or the old term was a torpedo, right, Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah. Guy used to call them torpedoes. The torpedoes, you know, some of it's just business. And maybe it's a way for them to get ahead, to impress the captain, to impress the boss or whatever. So they do it. And I would bet some of them may not necessarily enjoy it, but they do it anyway. And then there are those that enjoy it. So getting back to your question, if the FBI says that somebody kills three or more people that are considered a serial killer, I mean, that's just the definition. But serial killers, if you want to look at that, a serial killer, that may be true, but then there may be different types of serial killers.
Deep Cover will be right back after this short message. And we're back with Deep Cover.
Leo, I tell you, good. Frank and I are out in Las Vegas. I had a school out there. So after the school, I had to do a TV interview for a foreign television.
They were German, Joe.
Was it Germany? Yeah. So they wanted to do it on a rooftop of one of the parking garages. So, okay, we meet them, I don't know, 11 o'clock or something. And so we do the whole Megillah. So then after, Frank says, I'm hungry. And I'm hungry. So we go back to the hotel. Frank, what do you want? And both of us at the same time, he says, what do you want? At the same time, we said, a BLT and a cigar. So every night at 12 o'clock.
That's a marriage made in heaven.
every night at 12 o'clock, you know, we get done with the school, maybe, I don't know, 6:30, 7, whatever. And then, you know, we would do whatever we wanted to do, you know. But our deal was we meet back here at 12 o'clock tonight for our BLTs and our cigar.
And Leo, Joe would have a cup of coffee and I would have a chocolate egg cream.
Yeah. Oh, he goes back to the neighborhood. Neighborhood, a chocolate egg cream. You know, it's look, I could tell that he was very enthused to have you come on. And we were going to do it last season. Then we got moved around a little bit. COVID came. But he's a creature of habit. And he reads. He never stops. And you're never without your little book. What is that? That you read about war?
The Art of War.
The Art of War. He keeps that around all the time.
Art of War.
Yes, that's it. I guess you could take the guy out of the war, but not the war out of the guy. I don't know how that plays out.
It's a good book for young undercovers to read, The Art of War. Hey, Frank, I know Leo asked me this question. He said, what does the doc do when he relaxes? What does he like to do to relax? What does a psychiatrist like to do to relax?
Yes, I'd like to know.
It's a good question. And to be honest with you, I don't get much time, but I do enjoy. I tell you, I really love to be with my family. I have, you know, I enjoy being with my wife and my children. My son is a lawyer, and he's about to become an assistant prosecutor. And my daughter teaches, and I love to be around them. And my son's girlfriend is a medical student, and my daughter's boyfriend is a great guy. He's in the construction business. So whenever we can get together and have dinner, we love that. I love to eat, Leo. It's good you're only seeing me from the head up, because and when Joe's in town, we always go to dinner. We get together with everybody, and I like a nice cigar. I love music. I'm a bit of a musician. So I listen to all types of music. So those are the kinds of things I do to relax.
And you love your cigars.
Yes,
I do. I enjoy a good cigar.
You know, my daughter, and I don't know if they had this when you were coming up through the ranks in psychiatry. She's a psychologist, and she deals.
Oh, very nice.
Yes, she deals with young women. You know, going as young as 6 years old. She is a very caring person. Obviously, you are too. She is very family oriented, and you know she's dealing with the parents as much as she's dealing with the kids. Mm-hmm. You know, and she had to take a course that was recommended to her about how to leave it at the office, because she was taking it home with her. you know, it's I can see that that's really a danger, because you're a compassionate guy, you know, you love your fellow man. And was there anything like that available to you when you were coming up the ranks?
It's a good question, Leo. What we would do typically is we would have supervisors who we would meet with to speak about different patients and get input from them and guidance. And with that, we would also engage with them about ourselves and how we were doing. And they were interested in how we were doing, how we were coping. And so that is something that I did during my training. That doesn't really happen much now. And of course, you know, it's very difficult. You know, it's not the kind of thing I can come home and talk about patients because of patient confidentiality. I mean, that's available. If it becomes too stressful, we do have people we can go to and talk to. But oftentimes, we in my field are the people that the other medical specialties, in particular during the COVID pandemic, would come to. And we were always available for, you know, we saw a lot of COVID patients, and then we worked with the doctors and the nurses and the staff in places like the ICU and some of the more critical areas in particular. We even worked with our security people who had to deal with these COVID patients all the time to try to debrief them and diffuse their situation. But as far as us go, I mean, it's available. It's not the same as when we were in training.
You know, there have you ever, and this just came to me, have you ever been with a client or a convicted person, you know, that you were brought in by the FBI? Was there ever a time you felt threatened sitting across the table?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, we see people who are have criminal backgrounds and then come in. And, you know, I've been attacked a couple of times. Believe it or not, the worst attack was by a young woman who kind of blindsided me as I was walking by, and she scratched my face and attacked me. But it's not a regular thing. And the way the units are set up and the way our security people are, if there's anything like that, there's a lot of protection around. But yeah, I mean, it has happened, but it hasn't happened maybe a half a dozen times. And it's usually only the one time that I can remember that somebody got to me, so to speak, and, you know, took a poke at me. But the other times, you know, it's more verbal and stuff like that.
Looking into the mind of a terrorist, mm-hmm. I've dealt with both. And you're better off, to me, dealing with a criminal than with a terrorist. Not that a terrorist isn't a criminal, but I mean that mindset.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, Joe. And that seems to be the at least up until the pandemic, that was the thing. You know, a lot of it too is cultural. There are certain particular groups that'll carry out certain things. And, you know, I mean, and there's all types of terrorists. There are, you know, terrorists from foreign countries. There are homegrown terrorists, the people who blew up the building in
Oklahoma City.
Yeah, Oklahoma. And a lot of these people are zealots, and they really believe in what they're doing. And a lot of times they will recruit the underlings. You know, in Northern Ireland, that was a big thing. And actually, Giuliani was able to pick up on that. But, you know, the thinking was years ago, well, we're not going to waste our time on the little guys, the second story guys, the guys that pick your pocket and what have you. We want to go after the big guys. But in Northern Ireland, they really realized that it was the big terrorists that were using the little guys to steal the cell phones, to do things like that, so that the cell phones that were stolen could be used then to make bombs for the big guys to blow up cars. And that's why when Giuliani was mayor in New York City, he started to go after those people. And that's why for a while there, the city was looking good. But it's a little to the side of your question, was the mind of a terrorist. For the most part, those they're very different than you know, a wise guy. You know, talking to you, Joe, I remember asking about Lefty, and I asked you, I said, did he have any redeeming qualities? And Joe said, not a one. And and I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, he had a wisdom tooth problem. And he was moaning and complaining and moaning and complaining. And Joe had to hear this. And he said, and Joe said, about a month later, Joe had a toothache too. And he said something. We left. He says, "Come on, pull yourself together. Let's go." So they're not the kind. And they're afraid of pain. They don't want to get hurt. Yeah. But these terrorists, they kill themselves. They blow up. You know. So. It's a different mindset, a different mindset.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, because they're doing it for a cause.
Right.
The others are doing it for money, strictly money.
Right.
You know.
Doc, could I just ask, I did a movie years ago. It spawned some sequels. It was called Relentless. Robert Loggia, who Joe was a big fan of his, and Judd Nelson when he was hot. And my role, he was a detective partnered with Loggia who had an aptitude into the mind of serial killers. You know, okay, this is show business and there's a dramatic license taken. But I did do a lot of reading. And I read something, I still can't even get out of my mind, that a serial killer, like 98%, were abused as children. That stuck with me. But the other thing was that they couldn't differentiate or feel the difference between sticking a knife in a loaf of bread or in a person. That is that valid in any way?
Oh, sure, Leo, that absolutely. And these people who are these types of criminals fall in the category of what we used to say in psychiatry. We don't use the axes anymore. We used to diagnose people on three axes, axis one, axis two, axis three. And axis one were the main diagnoses like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, what have you. Axis two was set aside for any kind of intellectual disability, like if they had mental retardation, what have you. But the main diagnoses we put on axis two were the personality disorders. And one of the main personality disorders under cluster two was antisocial personality. And people with antisocial personality, exactly what you're saying, they don't have any remorse. They don't see the morality. Not only do they not see the morality, they don't see the repercussions. So somebody who may not necessarily have antisocial personality disorder may want to steal your wallet, but they may say to themselves, "Yeah, but if I steal his wallet and he catches me, and I may have to, you know, he calls the police, I'm going to get arrested." Antisocials don't even think of that. They just steal your wallet. They don't even care about how you're going to feel. You know, somebody else may say, if I steal his wallet, maybe all his money, he's got to get his credit cards, he's got his family. They don't care about it. They don't care about a thing. They just steal your wallet. And you are an object to them. You're not a person. And when they look at you and they size you up, they say, how can I get over on this guy, essentially? And that's an antisocial. And that's the same type of person who sticks a knife in a stomach or a loaf of bread, and to them it means nothing. If somehow they will get something out of it. And these antisocials make up most of the people in jail, and there are basically two types of antisocials. There's the obvious ones that we see, the people in the post office, the FBI's most wanted list, motorcycle gangs, thugs. And then there are the high-functioning antisocials, you know, the people in business, people in politics who get over on people. And they see other people just similar to the mob looks at people as an object. And how can I use that individual? How can I get over on them? What can I get from them? And again, these are the same types of people, not necessarily the business people, but the same types of people who will, like you say, put a knife in you or a loaf of bread, and it's meaningless. If they put it in a loaf of bread because it's going to help them, fine. If they put it in you and it's going to help them, fine. They don't differentiate it.
Thank you for explaining that in depth, because I'm sure our listeners out there, that they never really heard it explained that way. And it's a scary proposition, no matter. Let's change course a little bit now. I, Catholic, Joe's Catholic, you know, whatever religion you are, just if you believe, it's great. Have love in your heart. I have a friend from Brooklyn, and my father used to go to Mass every day. I go to Mass every day, okay? He's an actor from Brooklyn, Bobby Costanzo, great guy. And so he found out I go to Mass every day. And he goes, Russ, you go to Mass every day? I said, yeah, every day. He goes, "You every day you go to Mass? I said, which word don't you understand? Yeah, I go to Mass every day. He said, you must have some kind of guilt, Mo. And that's the way he perceived it, you know? He perceived it as, I'm there because I must be guilty. No, that's not why I go. It's the way I start my day up, you know? But now, when it comes to food.
You're reading my mind, Leo. You're reading my mind.
I know. Joe has, he said that you are a connoisseur of food. I would assume, he didn't get specific, Italian?
Yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, I don't know if I'm, Leo, I don't know if I'm a connoisseur, but first of all, I enjoy food. I think I know what I like, and I'm very honest. If I recommend a place and it's a dump, I'll tell you, I messed up, it's a dump. Because a lot of people say, no, it's good. But I have to tell you a funny story about Joe. Me, Joe, and a buddy of ours, Nikki, who is a DEA agent, go out to this place down here by the Jersey Shore. A really, really nice, you know, not a highbrow place, but a nice pub by the water, a burger and beer joint, but you can get great seafood and everything. And we're all sitting down and we're all, who got a burger? Who got this? Joe orders a Reuben sandwich. So we all kind of stopped and we looked at him. You see, you know, who got a beer? And I have a Reuben sandwich and an iced
tea.
Oh my God! I was embarrassed.
I just had the Woolies for Reuben. What do you want from?
No,
you
know? He's a handful sometimes. He really is, Frank.
And Leo, what he didn't tell you is when we were in Vegas. He was the first night I ate my BLT alone, and he was, you know, he was seeing all these assistant United States attorneys, these agents, they were all coming down. Joe, how are you bowing? You know, it's great to see you, this and that. So I'm sitting there, I said, Joe, I'm going to take a walk. And I got hungry, and I come back about 2 hours later, he says, Shoes, where'd you go? I said, Joe, I had a great, great BLT and a chocolate egg cream. He says, a BLT and a chocolate egg cream? What are you? Next night, he said, let's go for that BLT. Well, that's how it all started.
The power of suggestion. I was in an awkward situation. I wrote the script, the original script for the Gotti movie. And one of the stipulations, I had to go to where Junior Gotti lived. And they got me a nice house on the water because I was going to be there 3 months plus, you know? And I said, okay. Now, he was 4 months out from looking at life imprisonment for a triple murder. And he, whether you want to say beat the government, he won his case, okay? And I would be talking to him. I want him to open up to me. And I'm a friendly guy, and we would talk and this and that. And I would tell him, I said, you know what you don't see on menus anymore? Brajol. You don't see it on menus in Italian restaurants anymore. And for the audience, a brajol, it could be like a flank steak wrapped around, whether it's a hard-boiled egg or cheese, or whatever it is. And they put string on it, and it comes out like a nice little delicate thing to eat. I don't know how I'm delicate. So I would say that to him. And don't you know, he invites me over to dinner, and he makes brajol. I could have had a hacksaw, and I could not have cut through that cake. It was tough and gristly, and he probably thought I had a dental problem, because I would chew for 20 minutes before I even could say the next word to him, you know? And it was, when you're stuck in a position like that, where you got to, as they say in the neighborhood, nut it up. Oh, boy. Mm. Oh, you know. But, Joe, this has been a pleasure for me. And I know you and I are going to see each other. I'm doing a television series in Brooklyn. Joe's going to come. And we start end of August, September. There's a great Italian place, Bemonti's. In Brooklyn. Great Italian food. And we'll go. We'll have a ball.
Oh, I'd look forward to that, Leo. That'd be great.
Okay.
Frank, favorite cigar?
I think probably overall it's a Cuban, and it's a Cohiba Siglo Seis.
Okay.
That's a beautiful cigar. That's probably one of my favorites. And now another great one is a Plasencia, which is a Nicaraguan cigar.
Okay. Favorite pasta?
Bucatini.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yep. Favorite fish?
Favorite fish? Shellfish or regular fish?
Either.
Well, shellfish, soft shell crabs now, because you can get them. Yeah. And otherwise, a branzino, but the whole fish.
Oh, my God.
Mediterranean seabed.
Yeah,
branzino. I have to say something now. I love fish, but I can't stand bacala, because until I was 17.
No, I don't like it either.
I thought that was my first name. My father said, you bacala. I don't know. But it's been a delight, and I can't wait to meet you in person.
Same here, Leo. Thank you very much. Same here.
You're welcome very much.
I want to thank you very much. And you know I love you, man. I love you.
Love you too, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure.
So long, guys.
God bless.
Thanks to our producer, Monique Nethington. Sound designer, Casey Franco. Music and voiceover by me, Camille Stennis. And executive producers Maddie Stout, Rudy Solo, and MBB Media for putting this episode together. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for more Deep Cover updates, plus exclusive photos and content.